It's a group of people who some of whom know each other from their work, and others are strangers to one another, but we hope to really build this commission to be a community of people who are trading ideas and really bringing our energy to this endeavor. So first things first is get to know each other. I thought what I'd do is go by down the list by the role in which you're playing, pertinent to the bill's design. So I'll start with our two commission members who represent the state Senate. I'll start with Senator Henderson. What we'd like to do is, if you'd introduce yourself, give a little background, and then also tell us what you'd like to achieve with this commission, why you're here, and what you'd like to see happen with this commission, especially in the upcoming years, 2 years. So, Senator Henderson.
Well, I'm Senator Deidre Henderson. I was elected to the state Senate 2 years ago, and I'm from South Utah County. Previously worked with Congressman Jason Chaffetz, and love working on the state level because I like to be able to change things, and I can do that much easier on the state level than on the federal level. So I'm excited to be part of the commission. I don't have very many expectations because I don't know what direction we'll end up going, but I am interested in looking at, you know, some of the issues that I've dealt with personally as a woman in the workforce and in government, and would love to be able to help empower other women.
Thank you. Senator Luz Robles is out of town, so we will have to meet her the next time we meet. Our two representatives, first of all, is the bill's sponsor, Representative Selig.
So my name is Jennifer Seeley. I am the minority leader in the House, and yes, I was the bill sponsor, but I will say that this was a bipartisan and entire legislative effort. I think that there were, if any, no votes at all, maybe one or two people. And so this public policy measure truly was and is on behalf, I think I can safely say, on the entirety of the legislative body. And I appreciate every single one of you that is here. We are all very busy people, and public policy does not work if we don't have the implementation of this as well, too. This is something that I am extraordinarily passionate about. I believe that we need all members of our community together making decisions and participating in our economy if we want to maintain competitiveness, not only on a state level, but on a national and global level. And I think that everybody has something to offer. Everybody. So, thank you all for being here.
Speaker Lockhart.
Hi, I'm Leslie Lockhart, Speaker of the House. I was appointed to the commission by the minority leader.
I was appointed by the speaker.
Jen and I talked about this. We talked about this before the session, didn't we?
We did.
Your idea about this commission. So we worked. She did the heavy lifting, obviously, on this, but she and I worked together on some strategy, how to get it passed, how to present it, how to work on it, and I'm just pleased to be here. I agree with her. The more voices we have, the better off we are. And we make policy, so that's the goal.
I'll introduce myself. I'm Carrie Main. I'm the Research Director and Chief Economist for the Department of Workforce Services. Our Executive Director, John Pierpont, appointed me to represent DWS on this commission. I see our agency touching women in the workforce in many different ways. In my shop specifically, we spend a lot of time and energy, the team of economists, to understand women in the workforce, and we do our best to inform the public on the important role that women play in the economy. And I find this is an opportunity to take that data that we have and that analysis we have and turn it into actionable recommendations for policy. So I find this to be very exciting. Outside of my division, our agency as a whole is very often working with women who have weak to strong attachments to the labor force, and we want to see better and more support for women in the workforce in Utah. And I think DWS is a key partner in ensuring that the women in our state are able to contribute to the stature of the Utah economy in the way that Representative Seelig described. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Let's move on to our business representative, starting with Trina, who is representing our large-sized businesses. We've specifically, before I move to those introductions, we specifically in the bill were to reach out to businesses who have contributed in some way themselves to ensuring that women have positive experiences in the economy by supporting that work-life balance. So these businesses know how to do it at that private sector level, and we hope they bring their knowledge to this commission. So, Trina, please.
I hope I bring my knowledge, too. That would be a good outcome. My name is Trina Eyring, and I am the Senior Vice President and Director of HR and Talent Acquisition at Diamond Bank Corporation. And I actually asked Jennifer via email to be considered to be on this commission because I think it is so important for us to have a voice for women in our economy. I also want to let everybody know that I am very open to whatever the outcome of the commission is. I'm interested in hearing from the speakers today and defining our objections and goals going forward, and am just interested in defining that together as a group. So thanks for having me.
Then Anne Marie is representing our small business. It's interesting that she herself is employed by a small business, but that business happens to be the Salt Lake Chamber. So we will get heavy representation from business for her key strategic position.
I'm Anne Marie Thompson. I'm the program director of the Salt Lake Chamber Women's Business Center. So within the Salt Lake Chamber, I take care of things that are entrepreneurial. So I'm also, as well as representing small businesses and the business leader in the city of Utah, who employs, I guess the members employ many of our women who are in the workforce, but also as the program director of the Women's Business Center, we're on the ground level of assisting women in starting businesses. So my focus is small business as well as entrepreneurship for women and advancing women in general. So nice to be here. It was recommended by Heidi Walker as well when we are a part of the Salt Chamber.
And we were also charged with having representation from an individual who has specific knowledge of the demographics of our state, and that person here is Jennifer Robinson, a PhD, and the leader of the Center for Public Policy Administration at the University of Utah.
Thanks. I'm not sure I'm the best demographic person that the university has, but my goal is to be the conduit between this commission and all of the talent that's at the university. A lot of you know Pam Perlick, Jim Wood, Natalie Gochner. There is immense talent up there, and my hope is that I can help link us with all of that great research and the knowledge that's up there.
Okay. And then Anne Burkholder. Anne, I'd love for you to describe your role that you're going to be playing in this commission and representing the YWCA.
Yes, I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the YWCA Utah. And the YWCA has cared about women's well-being in the state of Utah since 1906. And the economic well-being is part of women's lives. And I think that the primary reason that I am on this commission is that the YWCA for almost 40 years has offered domestic violence services to women throughout the state of Utah. And domestic violence has huge economic impact on women's lives, particularly if they have to leave their home and the kind of financial support that they and their family had had. So huge economic impact, but also if you look more broadly at women in Utah, there are ways in which we lag in terms of earnings and economic security. So our economic well-being is not as strong as it could be. And so I'm delighted to be here and talk with you about that. I have no particular agenda in mind except to help women's economic well-being.
Thank you. And then not certainly last but not least at all, Judy Barnett from the AFL-CIO. Please introduce
me. Thank you. And oh my, I feel very honored to be on this commission. Thank you very much, Jen, and for all that you've done. Again, my name is Judy Barnett. I'm a 43rd year member of the labor organization, OPEIU, Office of Professional Employees. I'm also the executive director of the AFL-CIO Community Services, and I'm on the board and an officer of Utah Women in the Trades. And what the labor movement has been trying to do in the last 4 to 5 years, and probably in the 40 years as well, but most importantly the last 4 years, is reach out to women and let them know that there are alternatives. There are non-traditional jobs, there's non-traditional employment that they can seek, and also the training. We have an amazing apprenticeship training. We reach out to, we work with people, helping people at many times. I have women in my office that didn't have any idea that they could maybe become an electrician, or they could become a sheet metal or a welder. So I'm just feeling very honored to be sitting here. I believe that it takes a village for us, and I believe that through education, letting the women know what are options out there for them, that this could be a really successful commission. I'm here just to really listen and to see if there's anything that I might have with my experience as a single mother. I was an entrepreneur. So just to see what, how, if 3 years ago I was a single mom for like 30, 40 years. So anyway, thank you for inviting the labor union to the table. Really appreciate that.
And then if we all don't mind taking the time, I'd like to go around the perimeter of the room and have everyone here also introduce yourselves and maybe just a comment or two about what brought you here. So we're going to start in the corner.
Chris Smart, Salt Lake Tribune. That's my job.
Lucia Langston, I'm an economist with the Department of Workforce Services, and I'm here to present.
My name is Amber Johnson, also with the Department of Workforce Services. I'll be presenting at the Happy Time of the Day after lunch.
DWS link. I'm Tracy Gruber, also with DWS, and I am also presenting on intergenerational poverty and women.
Good morning, I'm State Representative Rebecca Sheldon Powell.
I'm Nick Gunn, Public Information Officer for Workforce Services, just here to support Carrie and learn about the issues so we can more effectively message about this to the community.
Hi, I'm Cindy Henderson, and I had to come here with my mom because I.
My name is Gretchen Anderson, and I'm involved in several initiatives related to women, and so I'm interested to see the work of this commission.
And I'm Jessica Staker. I'm an administrative assistant of the Department of Workforce Services.
And I'm Francisco Gilson, and I work with Mr. here.
Thank you all. Thank you, everyone. I'm very excited. I think we've got a lot of good energy and a lot of good talents that we're bringing together. I think Representative Seelig has brought together a great group of people. Moving on to commission business. We do still have one outstanding position that we need to fill. We have some work going on, and we think we'll have that likely filled by our next meeting, and we'll communicate to the commission once that position is filled, so that if anyone wants to reach out to this person, they'd be available. And then we have Anne Marie still to be confirmed, but we will get that completed soon. The next item of business is that, according to the bill, we need to, as a group, elect co-chairs. So I would like to open this to the commission to suggest individuals.
I'd like to make a motion.
Yes.
I'd like to move that Representative Jennifer Seelig and Speaker Rebecca Lockhart co-chair the commission until, as long as they remain in office or while they remain in office.
Second. Okay. So all in favor? Raise
aye.
Is there anyone opposed? We do have a quorum, so I think that that's decided. We have our co-chairs. really appreciate the two of you. And I didn't ask for your willingness. I think that you want to do it. Is there anything you'd like to say before we move on about taking on those roles? Or?
I think it's thank you for the vote of confidence. I greatly appreciate it, and I will tell you that over the next few months, until as long as my term is in, you all will have 100% of my energy related to this. You wouldn't be here if you didn't care. So I owe the topic, and I owe you all that energy and effort. So thank you.
I would ditto that. No secret. She and I are both leaving, but I haven't stopped working on it. I'm going to use my position as representative and speaker to pursue whatever I can until I no longer have those positions. So that's December 31st at midnight.
I remind people every day.
I had someone yesterday at church say, "Well, now that you're done," I said, "You're not new. When are you done?" December 31st at midnight. Oh, okay.
So there it is. I think that's plenty of time for you guys to lay out some groundwork for us to move forward on this. I think plenty of time for that. Okay. One other item of business is that another portion of the bill allows and encourages us to seek out grants in support of the work that we want to do moving forward. So it's important that as we are discussing the goals, that we ought to think, we can and ought to think well beyond the resources at the table. I have recruited a couple of individuals at the Department of Workforce Services who have experience in grant writing, so we will have that support. So as we're discussing how we want to move forward, please keep in mind the potential opportunities to get grants to support some research, surveys, program case studies. These are things that should and ought to be on the plate, and then as those ideas come build up, we will turn to the grant writers and maybe bring them on board to attend the next commission meeting, discuss with us ways in which we may move forward with and expand our resources for accomplishing our goals. Okay. I think the next thing we'd like to do, we really wanted to have Leisha Langston, who's an expert in women in the Utah economy, kind of just lay a groundwork for us. We need to know where women are in this workforce today to decide where the problems are and where we would like to focus our energy. So Leisha is going to present to us some really amazing data on women in the workforce.
I'm going to apologize in advance for too much data. So I hope you'll look beyond the data and look at what the data is telling us. And, that's my mind goes blank, I'm sorry. So I hope you look beyond the data, but to what it's telling us and how we're the same and how we're different. While we're waiting for that to boot up, in the first election following Utah's admission to statehood, which was in 1896, a woman by the name of Martha Hughes Tanner, known for friends as Maddie, ran for the Utah State Legislature. She ran against her husband, among other people, and was elected. She became the first female state senator in the United States, right here in Utah. We have a long heritage of women stepping up to the plate to help run society and be in the forefront of society here in Utah. And what's really surprising, and I think you'll see this in some of the quotes that you have, is that back in 1896 and 1913 and whenever we're talking about, the women of Utah had many of the same concerns that we do today, whether it's about equal pay, different segregation and occupations. Those things were still a great concern, or were a great concern, and they are still today. So, it's not going to work. Or not. I love technical difficulties. One thing I want to point out, as we go through the data, you're going to notice two things. The first thing is that, in many ways, we are not that different than our sisters nationwide. Utah's women, as we participate in the labor force, are in many ways the same. But, in many ways, we are significantly different. And we're going to talk about why that is, and how that relates to pay and occupation, and how the data shows up. Lest you think this is a totally patriarchal society here in Utah, even back in the early days of Utah, Brigham Young, our first governor, was talking about the importance of women being in the workforce. So while it's taken a while for that reality, for that to catch up with reality, again, that is where our roots are. First of all, it used to be that there were more women than men in the state. No more. We are now dominated by men. Not by very much, but slightly more male than female. It's a little bit different than the United States, where there's more women than men. And it didn't really happen until 2000. When we start looking at the data, what you find is that an influx of young male Hispanics really bolsters our male labor force and our male population. Utah is the youngest state in the nation. I once read that you're more likely to be run over by a stroller in Utah than anywhere else. And I'm pretty sure that's true because I'm daily dodging strollers. But you can see, if we look at the percentage of population under the age of 18, there's Utah with significantly more young people than the national average. So we're young. And why is that? Well, obviously, it's because we have more children in our families and a higher birth rate than the national average. And you can see that our birth rate continues to be significantly higher than the national average, although it also has dropped here in Utah. So we're not having quite as many children as we used to, but still significantly more than the national average. Of course, more births translates into larger families. And you can see here, compared to the United States, we have significantly fewer two-person families and significantly more five, six, and seven or more families. So we're young, women have more children, and of course our families tend to be larger. Another thing that's happened, not surprisingly, this won't surprise you, as we've gone over time, fewer women are now married at any one point in time. If you look back to 1950, which we kind of think as the beaver-cleaver, beaver time, you can see that in 1950, when they took the census, 69% of women were married over the age of 15. Today, 2012, only 56% of women are married, have a significantly higher level of divorce and intermarried. So women are delaying marrying, they're getting divorced more, and so at any one point in time, you're a woman to marry. One thing that might surprise you about Utah is that we do typically have a higher divorce rate than the national average. And because we have more children, and the way the health department calculates birth or divorce rates is per 1,000 population, it tends to understate our divorce rate because we do have so many children. It's kind of like per capita income, where ours is really low. We have so many children. Our divorce rate is really low, tends to be low, relatively, because we do have so many children. So, higher divorce rate on average. However, when you start looking at the U.S. compared to us, 56% of our women are married compared to the national average of 46%. Why is this? When we're divorcing more? Well, it's because we also get remarried more. Utah women marry young. We have, when you look at the median age at first marriage, ours is the lowest in the nation, lower than Mississippi, where we like to compare to everything else is lower. We are down there, and Intermountain West tends to have low marriage rates. This translates, and I'll just tell you right now, one of the things that they found in the academic studies is when women marry young, they are less likely to finish their education than our men. When women marry young, they are more likely to get divorced than men. So this young marriage age does affect the other data that you see. Now, it used to be that here in Utah, you know, we're really proud in Utah of our educational attainment, aren't we? Oh, we're better than the nation. We, you know, graduate from school, we go to college. Well, this will give you a clue how old I am. When the 1990 census came out, I looked at the data and I'm like, what happened? All of a sudden, our educational edge, or the share of our population that had a bachelor's degree or higher, was coming a lot closer to the U.S. average. So what's going on? So then we only got data every 10 years to look at this stuff. So you dig down in the data, and guess what it was? Okay, here we're higher. All of a sudden, we're lower. It's women. Women lost their educational edge. Okay? Men haven't. They're still head and shoulders above the rest of the United States in college attainment. But Utah women have lost their educational edge. And in fact, if we look at the gap between men and women, who have the percentage of the population that has a college degree, and we're just looking at people 25 years and older, Utah has the largest educational gap in the United States. And you can see it is by far the largest gap. Now, you know, I go through and I redo this chart every year, and up here where you see those negative numbers, that is where women's educational attainment is higher than men. And every time I go through and do this, you see more and more states moving up into the ranks of where women are better educated than men. Where are we in Utah? Now, we know that wages or education is one of the most important indicators or indications of how much you're going to make in the labor force. What does this tell you about women and men? We'll talk about it. So again, just some of the things to remember. Utah women get married young, we have more children and larger families. We've lost our educational edge. Now, it doesn't mean that more and more women aren't getting a college education. It's just that nationally, women are outpacing us. We have the largest college education gap in the United States. Smaller share of women are marrying, and that our divorce rates do tend to be higher. The biggest myth, I think, or the biggest counteraction to the myth that we're not so different than that. Okay, so how does this affect the labor market? We put all these things together, with the differences in culture which cause our demographics to be different. How does that affect us when we're in the labor market? Now, another thing I think that a lot of people are usually shocked to find out is that although before 1980, our participation rate, women's participation rate in Utah, fell below the national average, 1980 we caught up to the national average, and since then our participation rates have run higher than the national average. And you can kind of see a trend here. I actually dug out in our office, I don't know if we still have them or not, but I dug out the census books from 1900. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. 13% of women worked outside the home back in 1900. So you can see how that whole shift has changed and that we've really followed our national sisters into the workforce. You can also see that about right here we've plateaued out. It's gotten a little higher, but you haven't seen the huge increases that we saw in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. In Utah, you're most likely to work if you're a woman under the age of 24. You can see those are very high participation rates, essentially 80%. And when we get into the childbearing years, you can see their participation goes down. And, you know, the older you are, the less likely you are to work. And part of this is generational. Women in the 62 to 64 year range were really at the forefront of the movement into the labor market. So part of this is generational and the differences in how female generations enter the workforce, and part of it is because men also work less and we catch more retirement. Now let's compare us to the national average. Okay, nationally, we look at our young women. They are participating in the labor force to a much higher degree than the national average. You get down to about 24, we're still ahead, but the gap is closing. And then you get into the childbearing years, especially right in here, 25 to 44, and we, as women here in Utah, will tend to work less. We're still talking 72%, 67%, 72%. We still have a large percentage of our population for women in the labor force, but it's just smaller than the national average. We have larger families, a different culture, and you can see that coming out in the data. Okay, let's look at married people. I think this one is interesting too. If we look at married couple families, there is virtually no difference in Utah and the United States between the percentage of married couple families where both spouses are in the labor force. And we actually have a smaller share where both spouses are not in the labor force. So in other words, we work here. Work is important to us, or work is important to supporting your family, for whatever reason. We tend, as married couples in Utah, to work more than the national average, or to be in the labor force. So let's look at just mothers. So we looked at married couples, let's look at mothers, and you can see the Census Bureau breaks it out. We look at mothers with children under six, mothers with children who are under six, 10, 6 to 17. I remember those days. I'm not surprised at these numbers. Children 6 to 17 or no children. Now, I think what's interesting here is, again, especially when mothers have very young children and school-age children, and you know, you have children, you know the stresses and how difficult that is to keep it all together. Women are just more or less likely to work here in Utah. but still, more than half of them work. So it's not like, you know, we got 10% working, more than half work. Children under six, again, we're a little bit lower than the national average. And then when we get to no children, we actually work a little harder, or to a higher degree. And 6 to 17, you know, still a little bit of difference. But you can see those cultural differences and the fact that we do have large families, and it's a lot harder to work outside the home and have a family of six children than it is to have a family of two children. So I think all those things are in our demographics, not just the culture, but in our demographics of having more children relate to these data points. Now, we can look at it from the mother's point of view, but we can also look at it from the child's point of view. Children living with two parents, you can see that, again, here in Utah, they are less likely to have both parents in the labor force. However, if a child is only living with one parent, they are more likely to have that parent in the labor force. So you can see that. That's really, again, it's not that we do have a strong work ethic and we want to work, but if a lot of times, because of the large families and the culture, we tend to have a smaller percentage. Again, we still have most of our kids, especially in the school age years, have moms who are working outside the home. Now, I put in some county numbers. Because, let's see, you're out here from the Wasatch Front, right? Okay, Jessica's lost outside the Wasatch Front. And the data is driven by the Wasatch Front, and it's specifically driven by Salt Lake County because so much of the population is here. But I hope as you go through your commission and you think about the women of Utah, that you will remember that the labor force experience of many women outside the Wasatch Front is different than the experience of women here. The availability is different, jobs is different, the age structure is different, and all those things affect participation in the labor force. I happen to know that Paiute County is the oldest county in Utah. And you can notice they have a very low participation rate, and that's because they have a very high percentage of their population over the age of 65. And I can also tell you, since it's a county I do analysis on, there aren't many jobs there. You know, I like to tell people, you know, two people become unemployed in Paiute County, and the unemployment rate goes up a percent. So, but again, I hope as you work on this commission now, you will remember that there are very different labor force experiences in some of our smaller counties. Even though you can see some smaller counties do have very high participation rates. Women typically show higher unemployment rates than men. Now, is it because we have a harder time finding jobs? Probably not. It's because there's a lot more coming and going.
Yes. What do you mean by unemployed? Is that somebody who is looking for work, or is that somebody who is not working?
Correct. To be considered unemployed, you have to not have a job. So you also have to have made some work search in the past couple of weeks before they take the survey.
Okay.
So you do have to be looking for work. So if you've removed yourself from the labor force because you want to take care of your home, or you're retired, or somebody left you $1 million, if you're not looking for work, then you're not considered unemployed. And by the way, the work search requirement, the bar in that is very low. So, you know, if you ask your brother-in-law if you've heard of any jobs, then you're considered looking for work. Utah doesn't show up quite as well as the national average, but you'll notice that there are times when we have lower unemployment rates. There are times when women have lower unemployment rates. That tends to be during recessions. What industries do recessions hit? mining, construction, manufacturing are used typically hit the hardest, and that's where we have our casinos again. So in recessions, more men tend to lose their jobs, and so our unemployment rate of women tends to be lower. And they made a big deal about it during the last recession, but nationally it happened. We, as women, tend to work fewer hours than our male counterparts. Nationally, women work 36 hours a week. That's the median. In Utah, 33. So, three less hours, not a whole lot, but if you have four children as compared to two, you may realize why you're working a few hours less. For men, not much different. Utah men, again, do tend to work a few more hours than they tend to do. So, again, these are things I want you to keep in mind when we start talking about pay. Utah women are more likely to work part-time, both compared to men in Utah and compared to the nation. We're much more likely to work part-time. No surprise here. And here are the national numbers. So you can see, here's Utah. Can you see how much more we're likely to work part-time? Again, that relates back to the larger families. I think it just takes a lot more upkeep for a large family. Okay, so we talked about demographics, how they affect the labor force and how women work in the labor force. Now let's get dig down a little bit deeper, and we're going to talk about occupations and the occupations that women have in the labor force here in Utah and nationally. It used to be that, I wrote this article one time, and I kind of like it, so I'm going to use it on you. Never mind, because I can't remember. I've gone so blank here. Okay, what I want you to look at, let's compare 2000 to 2006, 2010, because they changed how they did the data. And if you want me to explain, I can explain that, why that is. But, so we're looking to see where have women made inroads into occupations? What occupations are, now more dominated by women? And to help you out, I've kind of darkened the bars here. And so when we look at this kind of 10-year time period, you can see that in protective service is one place we've moved into that, and you're like, what's that? Well, in non-bureaucratic language, that means police, sheriff, that group of occupations. So here's protective service. Another one where we've made lots of inroads are, personal care and service. I should know these off the top of my head. Personal care and service, I'm sorry to tell you, are well-paying jobs. They tend to be things like your stylist and CNAs and that kind of thing. So those are the well-paid service jobs that we're going to talk about. Another place where we've moved in, production. So women have moved into production occupations. That's basically manufacturing. So those are the kinds of the places where we've seen some big changes. Also in art, design, entertainment, sports, and media. Yes, they lump all those people together. But that's where we've seen some inroads. Have we seen a lot of inroads here into engineering in the last 10 years? I'm sorry to say no. And I started out to be a civil engineer, and I wish I could stay there. It's a lot better than economist jobs, I should say. So, not moving into computer mathematical, moving a little bit into business occupations. There really has not been much change in the last 10 years. When you look at women overall, and when we start looking at occupations, half of the return to death, but not a substantial amount. Okay, now we're going to look at us compared to the United States. Okay, compared to the United States, where are women significantly less employed than our sisters? Now you can see, and it's actually kind of hard to see because the bar is not up very good, but you can see that really occupations dominated by women nationally are the same occupations that are dominated by women here in Utah. So there's not all that different. I mean, not a huge amount of difference, but there are some occupations where we lag noticeably behind. What are they? Management, business financial, operations, computer and mathematical, all the sciences, community and social services, legal, healthcare practitioners, and technical workers. Okay, so these are the high-end healthcare jobs. Those are the ones we lag behind. We're not moving into those jobs as rapidly as our sisters are nationally. What do you also notice about that group of occupations? High pay or low pay? High pay. Okay? They tend to be higher paying. Remember that when we start to talk a little bit about wages. Okay. Let's look at the occupations in Utah that are dominated by women. Aides, preschool teachers, nutritionists, dental hygienists, stylists, secretaries, dental assistants, miscellaneous personal appearance workers, that's like your esthetician. Dietitians and nutritionists, do you notice something about these occupations in terms of pay? Other than this one, which is the exception that proves the rule. What do you notice about these where we dominate? High pay or low pay? Low pay. Okay. So again, these are where we dominate here in Utah. We're aides, not the occupational therapists, but we're the aides. We're the preschool and kindergarten teachers, not the high school teachers, not the college professors, medical transcriptionists, and you can just see on and on where the things are dominated, where we dominate. And let's see, I don't think nurses even made it on the board. Okay. Let's look where men dominate or where there's few women. Carpenters, construction laborers, automotive supervisors of construction trades, electricians, construction, welding. These are typical blue-collar jobs. Utah women, and we're not alone, U.S. women also, have been very slow to move into the blue-collar occupation, which if you don't have an education, are some of the better routes to higher pay. We've been very slow to move into those, but I'm sure you know. 1% of carpenters in Utah are women. Construction laborers, 2%. Your automotive service technicians, 2%. We just have not moved into blue-collar jobs. We actually have done a lot better moving into things that require an education as opposed to the blue-collar jobs, which I think is what causes some problems for women without an education, right, when we start looking at the data. And let's just talk a little bit about women-owned businesses. In Utah, the last time we took the economic census, we found that 25% of businesses in Utah are owned by women. However, what percent of sales do those businesses have? So we tend to be owners of smaller businesses rather than larger businesses. And we also account for a lot higher percentage of firms that have no employees. Okay, so it's just me working alone. Okay, so some things to remember about occupation and labor force. Most Utah women work. Most married women work. Most mothers work outside the home. We have higher participation in the labor force by our women here than nationally. We've been slow to move into higher paying occupations, and we tend to work fewer hours than men. Okay. So, let's talk about pay. This is Liza R. Snow writing in 1872 in a newspaper called The Woman's Exponent. And probably all most of you probably know who Elijah Hirschman is. Custom also says that if a woman does as much work as a man and does it well, she must not receive equal pay for it. And therein is a wrong inflicted upon her by the deprivation of a right to which she is justly entitled. So you love the language of the day. Back in 1872, Utah women were concerned about equal pay. So let's look at wages. When I started out in this business, eons of time ago, and I started looking at, I've been doing this stuff for a long time, I started looking at data for women in the labor force. If you looked at the wage gap, or the percentage of women earning compared to men, and these are median earnings, when you looked at that, it was a flat line. There was no closure in the gap. In fact, I didn't even see the chart in my publication when I did, because who wants to look at a flat line? However, you can see that since 1979, and these are U.S. numbers because there's no really good Utah data series, so we're looking at U.S. numbers. Mm-hmm. And these are weekly earnings. You can see that since 1979, which is about time I entered the workforce, 2011, that, you know, there hasn't been a huge shrinking of the wage gap, but we have made inroads as women compared to men in terms of wages. As our labor force participation has looked more like men, as our education has looked more like men, as we participate in the labor force more like our male counterparts, our wages have increase proportionally in comparison to there. So the gap has been closing, make no doubt about it. It doesn't close rapidly. But we're talking about groups of the labor force that comprise almost equal parts, okay? We're almost half the labor force of women compared to men. Now, if you look at the most recent American Community Survey data, you will find that in Utah, the median wage for year-round full-time workers is $34,062. For men, it is $48,540. A significant difference. In fact, we make only 70 cents on the dollar. Now, back in the dark ages, when I started looking at this data and I was a freshly minted economist, I was incensed. The data looked way worse then than it does now. I was like, in sense, I mean, this is like so not fair. And why is this, it's just really, really upset. But I want to tell you, as I have studied this longer, I have come to understand why that is. And I hope to share that with you, why the differences, and why we shouldn't necessarily be incensed, but see what we can do to make a difference. Now, if we look at wage gaps by state. You can see here in the United States, that same figure that I told you for us, which is basically 70 cents on the dollar, is 79 cents on the dollar. We're significantly behind the nation. And if you live in the District of Columbia, woohoo, yeah, looks pretty good. So maybe we should all go to Washington. Utah, it depends on the year. It depends on the year, but we tend to, and the data varies, but we tend to bounce around between 3 and 4 from the bottom. We have one of the largest wage gaps in the United States. Okay? No doubt about it. Now, the chart before shows you year-round full-time earnings. This chart shows you weekly earnings. And what do you notice about the number here? The gap shrinks when we go from a year to a week. And that's one thing I want to point out to you. The more closely we look at wages between men and men and make them apples to apples, the smaller the wage gap gets. Okay, so the closer, instead of comparing a year where maybe, women didn't work quite as many hours and they didn't work quite as many weeks, we have the bigger wage gap when we look at just 1 week and the usual earnings somebody makes in a week, the wage gap is smaller. In fact, when we start accounting for the differences in demographics and coming and going in the labor force and all those things, the wage gap gets smaller. This is just one way of showing you that that happens. Okay, now, if we want to look at the highest paying occupations for women here in Utah, and these are by major groups, by the way, so you can't get down to the detailed level and get really good data. But you'll notice that the high paying occupations for men are also the high paying occupations for women. So if a woman who's making a choice wants to make a choice for a high paying occupation, she can do that, and she's also going to make higher wages. Things that are low paying occupations for men and low paying occupations for women. Okay? Now this looks at the difference, the wage gap by these major occupational groups. And I love that there's hardly any female construction workers in Utah, but the few female, and these are construction and extraction, which is bureaucratic used for mining, but few women in these blue collar jobs make 95% on average of their male counterparts, which you need that number.
I know that number.
You know that number.
Yes, I live and breathe that number. I love that number.
So, you can see by occupation where the large gaps are. Unfortunately, places where we do tend to make as much as men as women also tend to be, apart from construction and extraction, tend to be lower paying service jobs. So, small gap in food preparation and serving, so waiters, waitresses, person that gives you your, hopefully not Big Mac, but something in the fast food window. Healthcare support, which is a lower paying CNAs, orderlies, dental assistants. Those are also places dominated by women where women, the gap is smaller. Where is the gap larger? Interesting in building grounds and maintenance cleaning. So janitors, go figure, there's a big wage gap, and doesn't include hotel maids, by the way. Health practitioners, where women tend to be nurses rather than doctors, although we do have a pretty good share of doctors. Sales, where women tend to be a cashier rather than commission sales, and in the legal occupations, where even though we've had lots of women enter law, still many women are paralegals as opposed to men. So it's just kind of interesting to see that where that wage gap comes out by occupation. So here's some things to remember. When it comes to wages, these are just things all the economists know. More education, the higher your wages. These are statistical relationships, not anything to do with any one person. More education, higher the wages. The more experience in the occupation, the higher the wages. The more hours worked, you're going to make more than somebody who works fewer hours. Even though, of course, we know that, never mind. Women can do twice as much in half the time. That's just because we're better at more hours worked means more pay. Occupations requiring more math, science, analysis, or management have higher pay. One time I just took the database off the BLS website, the Bureau of Labor Statistics website for wages, and I just ranked those puppies and to see where they, where the occupations came out. Not surprisingly, things that require math, science, management, and especially management jobs that require math and science, have the highest pay. Okay? Moving in and out of the labor force tends to lower your pay. If you have a break in service, it tends to mean you're going to have lower pay. Another thing that results in higher pay is more promotion. Okay? So those are just things I want you to remember and kind of think back about the data that we've talked about that help explain why there is a wage gap. So, there have been an unbelievable amount of studies looking at the gap between men and women's wages. And again, they try to get as close, when you get as close to apples as apples as you can, you start to see that wage gap disappear. And in some cases, it will completely disappear. If you compare someone working the same hours in the same occupation with the same work history and the same education, and you start looking at them statistically, the wage gap starts to disappear. Okay? In fact, the differences in what economists call human capital and your worker characteristics, whether you're old or young, you know, younger workers tend to make less than older workers, account for the vast majority of the wage gap. Okay? We want to make those apples to apples comparisons. However, there are things that we've also studied that help us understand why women make less than men. And one thing we know also is that I've never seen a really good study that gets rid of the whole thing. We just close it down to point it gets almost gone. Other things that behavioral economists have looked at help us understand how socialization and cultural expectations affect what women make in the workforce. I looked at one study, and they tried to see, well, are men more competitive than men? And what they found was that in most cultures, that is true. They used the, you know, a specific way to look at it. Men tended to be more competitive than women. But there were certain cultures where that was not true. They were cultures where there was a matriarchal society. Okay? When the women are in charge, women tend to be more competitive. They're socialized to be more competitive. So, you know, if we're looking at nurture versus nature, that tells us one thing. Another study that I saw that helps us understand that is they did a study with men and women, and they brought them in, and they had them do a math test, okay? And they scored their exam. And then they took them back out, and they offered money for correct answers. And here's what they found. Men who were offered money for correct answers, guess what happened to their scores? They went up. Women who were offered money for correct scores, hardly any difference. So maybe because of socialization or culture, we don't care so much about money as men do. Now, I can tell you maybe most of these studies with college students, so we're talking about women who haven't had a feed family for the most part. So that may be the reason. But we do know there are differences in how women approach money and competition that certainly factor into it. Unless you think I'm an idiot. Yes. Of course there's discrimination in the workforce. Is it easy to prove? It's almost impossible. There's no way to prove it. But the fact that we can't get away from the entire wage gap suggests that there is discrimination in the workforce. However, if you want to cut away at the big theme, making the difference between men and wages and women and wages, you want to cut away at this. We need to make our women need to have educational and occupational choice and experience the same as men. Those are the two biggest factors behind the wage gap.
Do you have any data where there are occupations where the gap is closed completely or that women are ahead?
Well, actually, women who work part-time make way more than men who work part-time. So that sounds like, and there are some occupations. And you kind of need to get to the national data. But what I found is that high-demand occupations like computer, mathematical, high-demand occupations tend to have much smaller wage gaps. And then there are some female-dominated occupations which have some allergy. But we don't want to be there. The structure nursing and hygienist, okay, where I just tend to be more.
Just really quickly, I'm wondering how benefits overlay on this. The reason I'm asking is because if it's part-time pay, oftentimes benefits are not part of that. Are you looking at wage in general with the benefits package on top
they
of that?
They just look at wages.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that would be benefit. There's no benefit in here. And I don't know about you, but I know a lot of women who work for benefits.
Yeah.
So, yeah, benefits are important. You know what's really is, yeah.
So, I didn't mean to interrupt your thought. Go ahead with that.
I was just going to say, you know, I used to do a lot of displaced homemaker workshops. And what I would have them do is I'd say, okay, give me a list of traditional male jobs. And we'd do the list. Give me a list of traditional female jobs. And we'd do a list. And then we talk about, we do a third list. What's important to me in an occupation? Benefits, you know, flexibility with my family, short commute time, you know, pay. And these are women who are really on the cusp. They haven't worked for, you know, 20 years, and they're now faced with the reality of having to support themselves and their family. And so they go through and make a list, and I would take them back and I'd say, okay, which group of these occupations meet your needs over here? Even with, I mean, sometimes we think that these female-dominated occupations are really flexible. They're not. I mean, let's be honest. If the boss is gone, who cares, right? But if the secretary is gone, everybody's upset. So, you know, there tends to be less flexibility even with a lot of the female-dominated jobs. And so I think it's important because I think that goes along with occupations too. And education. Those things become just really important, I think, as we look towards closing the wage gap. We need to have those choices for women be best. Okay?
Do we have any, okay, maybe this, I was going to ask if we got any race and ethnicity breakdown, and then also I wanted to do a little pushback on a statement related to part that you can't prove discrimination within a job setting.
Well, I
would say that you can. I would say that although it manifests itself in different ways that and our legal infrastructure makes that extraordinarily different. For example, being able in a lot of places, you cannot communicate about what it is that you make. So if you're in a vacuum and don't have the information, then you can't, you don't know that. Also, discrimination can manifest itself in ways that do not reach standards of legal proof, and they're called microaggressions, and they're very well documented, and they're things about they can either take a strong form of nasty language, which would be legally actionable, but also communication of other cultural values, like, really, Jennifer Seelig, do you think that you'd be the mother that you want to be if you want to be an executive, for example? A hypothetical. I mean, other things like that. So, I would say that it is very real. I don't know about frequency, but to say that it cannot be proven, help me understand.
And you're exactly right what you're saying. I should have phrased that a little different. We can't prove it from the data, statistically, over a large group. You're exactly right. You can certainly prove discrimination in a firm.
I'd like to just echo what Jennifer was saying, because women are, we and I'll include myself, are the worst negotiators when it comes to our salary. And we are so intimidated by if we have a male boss and even a female boss. And we're so intimidated that we don't sit down and say we are worth this. And so is that discrimination, or are you feeling a hostile environment by being interviewed by this person about what your wage is? would be.
Or say socialization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
See, am I not worth that much? Or no, this is the bottom line. This is what I'm worth, and this is what I want to start with. Therefore, we take the lower pain.
And you're exactly right. I should have phrased it different.
But you've also
statistically, it's hard to prove discrimination over like 5 million people.
So you've also raised an additional very helpful point related to data gathering and being able to understand the landscape in which we operate. At least a lot of what I'm hearing you say, please correct me if I'm wrong, but coming out of the Census Bureau or wherever it is that we're getting the big picture information, that is an issue that has not been addressed or is difficult to measure.
It's difficult to measure based on the data.
Okay.
But you're certainly right. There's certainly ways to prove discrimination. People do it every day with the EEOC. So, but statistically, there's no way to really get at it unless you get down to apples and apples. Same wage, same education, same time in the labor force, on and on. And then the wage gap does get very, very small.
Would it be fair to say that labor that's managed by a contract, where it is a certain number of widgets or whatever that's manufactured, that the wage gap is lower, or I don't know if low is the right word, that it's narrower because there is mandated equal pay for equal work? Meaning if I'm in an assembly line, the gentleman standing next to me and I are making the same widget, there is no administrative discretion on related to anything. Is that a fair statement?
Right.
Sure.
And, you know, it's interesting, too. You know, when a lot of law schools went to blind reviewing of applicants, not knowing gender, sex, race, and ethnicity, that women's acceptance rates went way up, same with minorities. So I don't want you to think I don't think that it's there or that you can't prove it on in a company-wide basis or a personal basis. It's just really difficult to get at it
from a
large aggregate.
From the way that we measure.
Right, exactly. Yep, exactly. Yes.
So do you have data that, I mean, looking at a job that someone just, like Jennifer said, just, you know, that's their job, what about advancement opportunities? Because I have seen, maybe it's anecdotal, but you talk about biases or discrimination that is hard to prove. I think in our culture, this, well, we have to not be, you know, we can't have men and women be together because it looks improper or, you know, the separate, the equal. I mean, Plessy versus Ferguson was overturned over 100 years ago. I mean, but I see that. I see that still in a lot of places, that we have to keep the men and the women separate. And when there's only a few women, it creates this very uneven playing field. So I would be interested to see if there's data on advancement that, you know, when you can't be part of the club because of your gender, you know, because it's inappropriate. And you know, that's something that I've encountered personally in multiple settings, and it's incredibly frustrating. And so, you know, that would be something that I would be interested in seeing if we have any data.
Yeah, I have not seen anything other than, you know, there was the Glass Ceiling Initiative, which actually went into lots of Fortune 500 companies and looked at, and they definitely found issues. But again, just the aggregate data, the way we have it, there's no good way to get at that.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are certainly true, but what back to my other
point.
If you want to attack it, if you want to attack the big reason where we have, as women, the power and the personal choice, and excuse me because I'm not speaking as an economist, I'm speaking as a woman, this is where we attack it. That's where we get it. Because that's where we have the power and the choice. And I think as that happens, I've been around long enough to see the workplace change dramatically when it comes to women. and advancements and those things, just because, you know, we're so much there now than we were 30, 40 years ago.
But Senator brings up, can't you get at that advancement of data? I mean, you can look at the average time someone's in a job before they get a raise, before they move to the next level of, can't you look at that and the comparisons between men and women? And because I see it not, I've experienced this, I can't really take you to lunch because you're a woman and I'm a man, and it might look like we're having an affair, or, mm-hmm. right, this kind of thing.
And that indignation of motive is incredibly offensive.
Mm-hmm. It's horrific, and it holds women back in the workplace. Because it's no big deal for the guys to all go out, no one thinks they're having an affair.
Right.
If I'm at a restaurant with one of my colleagues having a business lunch, someone's going to say, what's going on? You know, it's unfair. It's wrong and it's unfair.
Especially if you're a single woman. Yeah.
Perception. Right. But even more than that, I think in the arena of getting advancement, we still, the boss may think, you know, or the committee may think, well, she's got kids, and so she'll have less time, so we'll give the advancement to the man. Or the man's the breadwinner, you're not, so we'll give the advancement to the breadwinner, not to the
I can't just find that data.
We have a longitudinal database that asks those questions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know one, do you, Carrie?
Not off the top of
my
head.
No, I don't. So, if you want to attack that one, get some money for data collection.
Okay.
Yeah, because you have to have a longitudinal data, which is something that follows people over
right.
time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way the data is collected now, anybody ever been part of the American Community Survey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was so excited. Yes, I'm a data geek. But that's not, they just say, well, what's your occupation, what do you make? And so you have to have a longitudinal database that follows people over time. And you know what? I have no doubt that it would show that, because I, like you, have been in the labor force and experienced those kind of things. However, I'm telling you again, if you really want to make a dent in it, this is where you want to make the dent. Helping women make better choices about their labor force participation and the fact that they're going to be doing it. Because there's still a huge amount of our young women who do not think they don't think they're going to be working. I hate to tell you, there's a lot of them out there. I spoke to a bunch of young women, and I'm like, okay, so what do you want to be when you grow up? And they go around the table and they want to be a manicurist. And I mean, like, every single female-dominated occupation that pays love you could think of. And I'm like, so how many of your moms work? They all raise their hand. It's like, we're not making the connection here. So anyway, that's my personal opinion. But because if you look at the data, that's where the big gaps are. Education, occupation.
Jennifer, sorry, you had a comment.
I have a couple of questions. One, a request to the chairs to see if we can start a list today of a data question and ask Carrie and the DWS team or maybe others to do some analysis for us. And then I have a couple of questions for the group, and this might just jump onto your list that I'm asking for.
I wonder, let's go ahead, and if you don't mind, Misha, can we just use this as a segue into, I think this is moves into our next agenda item, which is talking about our broader goals, moving forward, what we want to accomplish, is that?
Sure.
Okay.
Can I just say two more things before I close? If you ever have any questions about the data, please feel free to call me, because I've been around long, I know where most of it is, and I can pull it up really quick. You have my contact information on there. Also, on the handout that you have, it has a link to a visualization that we have for data for women in all counties in Utah. So if you're interested in looking not just at Utah, but you know, the people from in Salt Lake County, Cayuga County, that information is there.
There were actually a couple of slides that were skipped over that I think are really important, particularly in light of your comments about how important education and occupational choice are. Opportunity and access to both of those things are critical as well.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for us to understand women and poverty in Utah, and also how that shows itself in different ethnic groups. So if we could just do that before we stop,
okay.
I think it's important for the conversation.
This just shows, I just grabbed some table and pulled this out. Who's most likely to be poor? An unemployed female. If you're Hispanic, Latino, you're next on the list. Native American Indian, unemployed male, less than a high school graduate. Okay. Again, all those things right now in Utah's economy tell us who's going to be poor. The least likely to be poor are people with bachelor's degree and higher, 65 years and older. Yes, it's true. Why do we give senior dates? Employed males, some college or associate degree, if you're white and not Hispanic, if you're an employed female, these are the people least likely to be poor. And then, so rightly pointed out, these are, we need to look at that in the context of ethnicity and race as well. Oh, this just looks at households. If you really want to be poor, be a 5-year-old in a female-headed household.
The risk of, so being Hispanic or Latino or Native American is your race. You can't do anything about that. So as you drill down into that, what is it? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a discrimination thing? Is it, what is it?
I think
what are the risk factors associated with being born Hispanic and that's your risk? I mean, you see what I'm saying?
And
how, what is it about that?
Because a lot of the same things are the same things that are why women make less than men.
So they're choosing
less education.
Education.
Less education. If I showed you the occupations of Latinos, they're very different. So, but that's part of because we've had a lot of in-migration and that's going on. So I think all the things that make a wage gap between men and women also go into wage gaps for different ethnic groups.
And, well, specifically with your American Indian population,
yeah.
And their heavy predominance of certain areas and the job availability, huge issue there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, culture, I mean, but how do we chip away at it? I think that's the important thing. Any other questions?
I do. I have just one more. And can you just remind me, what's the gap in Utah when we're controlling for education between men and women?
I can't get at it. I have to go pull some data because they don't publish it.
Yeah, because that's what I'm really struggling with. Because we've been talking about that 70% gap, right? And you keep telling us it's education, education. I want to know when you control for that, where's that gap end up?
Well, I don't have good data now, but when I've done things, I published the data in the past.
Mm-hmm.
If you have no education, you have a very small wage gap.
Okay.
So if you don't go to high school, yours is about the same as guy. And if you have, the more education you have, that tends to decrease. It's not completely gone away with, though, because there's, again, a difference in occupational choice.
So
if we could get at that, I
just
say that.
Would some of it be a little bit more appearing if we're looking at it by occupation? Some occupations, they require a certain level of education.
Right.
So I imagine that some of it might be there, although it's not.
And again, the detail and the way it's published right now is just not there for Utah. It is for the U.S. So we can look at that. And we could look at the pumps data, but it gets kind of scary. When you get down to the occupational level, and you only have the just, it's not very solid because you have so few people in the sample when you get down to the specific occupation. So sometimes it's, you don't want to use it because you make false assumptions. But the national data is very strong. So, yeah, we're not that different. Honestly, we're not that different in the U.S. So we can get down to it very easily on the national level, down to those little details, occupation. But then again, you need to control for education and maybe get on the workforce and the hours worked. And again, the studies that have done that get really small.
Very good.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Feel free to call me if you have any questions about the data. These slides will be posted on our website.
We have, for the commission members and speakers, we have lunch out in the hallway. Should we take about 10 minutes to gather our lunch and drinks and settle, and then maybe, if you don't mind, we'll continue our conversation while we munch on our food.
Okay. Karen, can I just say one thing, which is that the YWCA this past year commissioned some research from the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and released a research briefing at the beginning of May with data on a number of dimensions of Utah women's lives, including earnings and economic security, and did some breakdowns in terms of race and ethnicity. So I have brought copies of these today in case you haven't seen them. And would be very happy for you to take those with you. They corroborate some of the things that Lisha said and gave some information in areas where she didn't. So I think that they will interest you in connection with the work. So you're welcome to those.
So lunch is out, I think, on a table we've got here.
Okay. Can we pretend that I'm taking a piece of silverware and knocking it against a piece of crystal? Thank you.
Oh, no.
That was my insult to a speech. So item number 4 of the agenda is identify mission and year one goals. And we're in a context right now of the time limitations. We've got about an hour and 15 minutes for the rest of the items. And I would ask people to, everyone's got a copy of the bill that's in the folder, and between lines 124 and 137 relates to the shall or the mandate of the legislation. So we shall facilitate the communication and coordination of public and private entities that provide services to women or protect the rights of women, study, evaluate, and report on the status and effectiveness of policies, procedures, and programs that provide services to women or protect the rights of women. Study and evaluate the policies, procedures, and programs implemented by other states that address the needs of women in the economy or protect the rights of women. Facilitate and conduct the research and study of issues related to women in the economy, provide a forum for public comment on issues related to women in the economy, provide public information on women in the economy and the services available to women, and encourage state and local governments to analyze, plan, and prepare for the impact of women in the economy on services and operations. And then there's following a list of measures. So it's a wide breadth. On the agenda, we've got year one goals. The only thing that I can speak to right now in relation to my service on the commission would be until December 31st at midnight. And that would be on a lot of the discussion that has come forward thus far relates to what it is that we know or identifying the landscape in which we operate. So there's data, and we saw some of the stats here today, but we've also raised other questions that we may or may not have information related to. And statistical data is one very important piece of the lens through which we view our world. There's also individual stories and lived experience that does not often get measured. And so the questions that we ask are extraordinarily important, and I would have been energized by a lot of the discussion that has taken place so far, because there's been an identification in some areas of lived experience that we don't really track, and I think that we have an opportunity to do that. And part of this, in hearing the forums for public comment, I take that very seriously. And I think that that's something that I would encourage and asked everyone to think about what that looks like. So often we formalize that process, like in a town meeting or some other format, which has its benefits, but it also has its drawbacks. Because we ask a community for people to stand forward and talk to us honestly in ways about how their job experiences have impacted themselves and their families and their education. So that can be very difficult. It would be my goal, personally, within the next few months, is to, and it's consistent with what Jennifer Robinson mentioned, about questions about where we have that are coming up based on the data that are presented to us, and how we can obtain that information. That's my thought. Anyone else?
This always gets away. This is what I would invite you to consider is when you're selecting women's stories, not only to collect the challenges that have been encountered, but the opportunities that some of our corporations or industries, what good is going out there, ideas for best practice.
And I appreciate that thought, and that's, I mean, in part why from a formal infrastructure standpoint, while our business community is on, because they have been recognized for some of the great innovations that are there. And also, there was a mention, or in part of the language, it was written related to comparison of other states. I'd also like for us to be open to comparisons of other countries. I actually met with a French parliamentarian the other day, and she was talking about some of the challenges that their women and families have as well, too, but also some of the innovation that they have exhibited was very interesting, and I don't think that we should be limited.
Are you raising your hand?
I am.
Follow me.
Does anyone else in the room have their hand raised?
Oh, cute.
You got
I think what's also important is that now you've made me forget my thought.
That's my fault. Had a collection of other countries.
Oh, I think we need to evaluate the policies that the state has. Mm-hmm. For instance, we know that childcare and childcare subsidies are very important for women, especially single women, who are out looking for employment and how many hours they can work and so forth. So what are the specific policies in workforce services on state nurses? What are the policies when it comes to the benefits that are provided? And do we have a cliff? And if we have a cliff, why? Right? So a woman makes so much and she gets a lot of help. She makes a dollar more and she gets cut off. Well, where's the incentive to make more? Where's the incentive to advance and to if there's no benefit anymore, right? There's no help anymore. And so as policymakers, those are the kinds of questions we need to have the answers to. What are policies that we can have influence on, changes to the law, changes to the policies that will enable women who are trying to work up and that, to me, is the policies around this issue that are important.
That's huge. And we had encountered an experience that was unanticipated during the legislative process of this at committee hearing. There was a woman who was at a political subdivisions meeting on another issue. And she came up and talked to me about this. She has a large family, and she and her husband both work. She wants to shift her time more to home, not only because of her children, but because of her parents. And she was not able to receive a business license from the city in which she lived to make costumes. She sews and wanted to do a home-based business to be able to sew them and send them away, either dance costumes or Halloween costumes or whatever it was. And so that was another governmental restriction that could actually allow family flexibility to be able to do some things that they wanted and to be innovative and entrepreneurial. So those are also things that we can identify too as opportunities where we restrict when we shouldn't.
I'm glad you brought that up as far as not just employment with other organizations, but self-employment. I know that one of the screens talked about there's quite a high percentage of women who work with no employees, when technically there is one employee themselves, and they're the owner of the business. And of course, coming from the whole business and entrepreneurial side, I think it's really important to look at. A couple of weeks ago, I was actually at a Senate hearing at the U.S. Capitol on cancer versus barriers to women's entrepreneurship. What we heard from Maria Contreras Keys, who actually is the head of SBA Women, asked Congress or the special Senate for three main things, and that's assistance for access to capital, which is a thing that's difficulty for women getting into funding to start a business. Another was access to appropriate training and consulting and services, which was specifically about raising the funding for the program I work for. And then also the third part was access to federal contracting. They wanted to change some of the rules about federal contracting so women were able to get sole source contracts, which means not all of them have to be competitive. Because once you open up to, you know, being competitive, especially in one of their programs, it's hard for them to find another woman-owned small business like theirs to even compete against. And so they're even excluded that way. So those are some of the things that are going on, at least on the federal side, and I think we could do just as well. I mean, Utah's such a business-friendly state compared to others, but there are still things about women entrepreneurs as opposed to men.
When was the date of that hearing? Because I would
have
the facts to maybe help us get the transcript from that.
It's right on, of course, it's online. I have copies as well.
Thank you for that feedback. That's huge.
It was really amazing.
Could we also, to build on what Peter Lockhart said earlier and what Lisa mentioned during her presentation, could we have a little bit more information from UWS at some point about their displaced homemaker funds, whether those exist anymore, what the, if they do, what the source of funding is, how they're used? Because they would certainly be, that's the sort of funding that would be really helpful for women who are forced into homes. So I'm curious about the current state of that and whether it's going to be.
Do you happen to know, Amber?
I do. Those funds were sunset about a year ago, and so those funds are not available anymore. In terms of using them for helpful reasons, they, you know, when they leave their home to establish another, you know, as a primary help, what do you use those funds for? Where do you think they're going to be looking at another program, maybe another program that you need?
So it might be something to look at, depending upon what the source of that funding was.
Yeah,
there may be another purpose than to just help.
And I would chime in second what Speaker Lockhart said about child care. We found not just in terms of participation in the labor force, but also participation in public assistance programs. We have found the most effective way to get positive outcomes from those is to ensure that there's child care coupled with that program, that the most success occurs when a single mother has that child care component. And sometimes success in that public assistance program, success meaning making that transition to welfare work, well, from welfare to work, that's the first step that we see for some women before we see the success in the labor market. So I would second that focus on child care.
Okay, so this is living and evolving, right? The other part of this, too, that I'll add is that the first part was determining the landscape in a real and meaningful way with the different kinds of information and data, and the second part of this is action. And those of you all who know me, and the speaker for that matter. And actually, there were discussions related to all of you and why those recommendations were made to the board. it's not, the information gathering is the first step. We will accomplish something. And I mean that.
And Jen, maybe that becomes evident over the next several months what those goals are.
Right, oh, absolutely. I think they'll come up as we learn.
Yeah. So I have another data request. I'd like to see some more information on education. So a couple things are coming to mind. Graduation rate compared by men and women from high school, college entrance rate, AA rate, graduation rates with a bachelor's degree, those kinds of things. I want to see where are we seeing the growth and a dropout at what age?
AA.
Okay.
Jennifer, do you think it would be, both of you, Jennifer, do you think it would be appropriate to dovetail with that information what sorts of degrees they are seeking if they do get into pursuing their bachelor's degree?
Yeah.
Because if the gap between completion is accurate, that Lisa was talking about, that's critical. But it's also important what Lisa was talking about, what young women are choosing as their occupation for college.
I agree.
There's a way that we can...
And part of this is I know that it's iterative, so the more answers that we get, I think they'll probably inspire more questions. Yes, ma'am.
I think we have a good data source on this. Not only what we have through the Census Bureau that we'll touch on some of these, but also the Utah Data Alliance would be a good source for us to look. We can even look at degrees by field and then areas, industries of employment. So we can see if women are benefiting, not only are they attaining those degrees, but then are they turning it into gainful employment that's commensurate with that degree. So next on our agenda is to, as we've touched on a little bit in the bill, we're supposed to be, I describe it as building a catalog of resources that are available to women at different stages in the economy. And I thought, what better place than to just walk upstairs in my own building and say, well, what does EWS have to offer? So this is sort of a first step of understanding what resources are available to women. And so Amber Johnson, who is a program specialist, am I getting that right? Program specialist in our training division and workforce development will be giving us an idea of what EWS has to offer to women.
Good afternoon. Thanks for letting me come today to talk about our program. So in your handout, in your packet, it has a bunch of slides and a bunch of information crammed onto those slides, because I'm not necessarily going to talk about the specifics of each and every program, but certainly if you have any questions about any of the programs and you want a little bit more detail, I would be happy to provide that for you. I wanted that as a takeaway for you, so you could take that with you and look at the programs. And certainly, if you have any more questions or follow-up or anything, you're welcome to direct those to me or Carrie, and she can send those to me. But really, what I wanted to talk about, Lisa went over a lot of amazing statistics, and she shared a lot of those with me before, which I'm going to touch on as we go through this. I want to give a face to those statistics. Okay, so I'm going to introduce you to three women. These women, their names have just been changed to protect the innocent, but they are all based on real situations, real women who have sought EWS services. This is what I think EWS has. Really, our primary goal is
our primary function is crisis intervention. People who come into our doors, people who contact us, they need help. They can't do it on their own or they wouldn't be coming in our doors. So we would look at crisis intervention. And you'll see that these women today, they are in crisis in some way or another. And as you'll see through these scenarios, that these individuals are, they seem to be doing the right thing. You know, the things that we think that we should be doing as we go along in society as women, and then something happens. Something that could seem very small, very slight, but it really does bring our walls crumbling down. And that's where DWS comes in. We're there to kind of get the shovel and help them build up a rebuild for it, okay? So, yeah.
I think I've got
is it working?
Kind of point to that.
Perfect. Okay. So the first thing is crisis intervention. The second thing is helping women build their skills. And we talked about that in terms of education, right? Nobody can get anywhere in society, whether you're male or female, without a certain skill set. And the greater our education, the greater we are to hold ourselves steady in terms of an incident or a crisis. That's really what that means. And then the third thing is being able to market those skills. So we all have skills. We all bring skills to the table. We all have strengths. But oftentimes women, we've talked about in here today, we're not always the best at selling those strengths or even acknowledging those strengths. And so that's something else that we help people with when they come into our doors, okay? So we're going to talk about our services with three women using these three situations, okay? So first, we have crisis intervention. So our friend Kelsey here, she's been happily married for 2 years. She's earned her degree as an RN and has been working in a home health care facility in Utah County. She's a real person. This is her real situation. She seems like she has her ducks in a row, right? She's young. She's married. But she went to school. She got her education. Her husband's going to school full-time to finish his degree. She's the primary support of this family right now, okay? But that's okay because they're okay right now. They just found out they're pregnant. It's like such an exciting time for them, right? She's working. She has health care. Her husband's going to school. He'll get his degree. He'll begin working in an awesome occupation at the end of his degree. But then he'll get laid off, okay? So what's she worried about right now? What would you be worried about?
Health insurance, right.
Yeah. She's got this little baby she has to take care of. Okay, what's going to happen, right? If you don't get your vitamins, if you don't get, I mean, it just could bring about a whole additional set of issues for that next generation, okay? What else did she worry about? She was a primary breadwinner. Now she's not. Now they're zero breadwinners, right? How are they going to pay their bills? How are they going to make ends meet? What's going to happen tomorrow, okay? So this is what DWS can offer her. We offer her unemployment insurance. She has worked, she's been a member of the labor force, and she's worked, and so she can apply for unemployment insurance and get a weekly subsidy. Now, as part of that, you have to be available and willing to work full-time. And we saw often women work part-time because of the children. They have children yet, right? So she's going to work full-time. She's going to get that weekly subsidy to help them make ends meet, okay? Do you guys have any questions about unemployment insurance?
No, she's pregnant.
She's
going out into the workforce. And you can't ask her if she's pregnant.
Correct.
She's going to have a family, but if you're showing, I mean, that creates another problem.
We talked about discrimination earlier, right? We talked about the elephant in the room.
Right.
A woman who is showing anywhere, and they go out and apply for the job, that's something the employer's going to be like, hey, now, how do I know you're going to come back after you've had that baby? Because in our society, it could very well be there's a very large possibility that she may not come back to work with preschool age children, right? We saw the statistics that Lisa showed us. But that's not a question that they can ask, but could they certainly act on that in their own best interest? Absolutely. Okay?
But that's one of those discrimination things you can't do.
Yeah. It would be difficult.
Can't really.
So the other thing should we talk about is her baby. She needs medical insurance. And so we offer a variety of Medicaid programs. So these are low-income programs. So this is different than what ACA does. ACA is the next level up. These are for individuals who have low to no income and they can get, or disabilities, and they can get these on these programs. So one of the cool things about Kelsey, when she gets on this insurance, her Medicaid, she cannot lose it. So she will have it throughout the duration of her pregnancy, unless she gets on a job and she chooses to go on to her employer's health insurance at that time. But oftentimes when you start a job, there may be a 90-day waiting period, something like that, but because of this health insurance, because we want to care for that baby, there won't be any lapse in that. She can carry on with that, whether or not she has income through the duration of her pregnancy. That's kind of cool. That's a big support. That's a big relief for Kelsey. That's Kelsey's story for right now. Do you guys have any questions?
The question. So, but after, isn't it 6 months after she has the baby, is she no longer covered by Medicaid? Is that her child can be covered, right?
If they're not income eligible, the baby can be on Medicaid for until they're a year old after her, and you know, without, if she doesn't have any other options for insurance. Yes, so it's up to 1 year for the baby. Okay. So here's our friend Jane. Jane has been married for 15 years. She has 2 children in elementary school. Okay, 6 and 4. She has a college degree, but she's not worked the entire time she's been married. So again, she did what she thought she was supposed to do, right? She went to school, she got her bachelor's degree, she has her education. Whether or not she did that during while she was married or before, she has her 2 children, she's happy family life, right? After her husband left for work this morning, she packed a bag for each of her children and left, and for herself and left home. She only knows one thing, is that she needs to pick up her kids at 3 o'clock when they get out of school, and she doesn't know where she's going to go after that. This is not uncommon. If you look at the statistics that were just shared with us to YWCA, more than one-third, 36.9, 40%, of Utah women have experienced some sort of violence or fear, and that's slightly higher than the U.S. rate. 40% of Utah women could be just like Jane. Okay? Jane has her education, but what does she do? Where is she going to go? And I think that's something when people have crisis in their lives, they can't think outside of here. It's just like from minute to minute. What are they going to do next? And this is the thing, is she only knows she has to pick up her kids. That's the routine. And she knows she has to get them before her husband finds out she's gone. Okay. So what are we going to do for Jane? We have this awesome cash assistance program called Family Employment Program. What Jane can do is she can participate in this program. She can receive a cash subsidy. Now, for a household of 3, get right, $498 per month. Okay, has anybody looked at rent for an apartment lately? She's going to be able to get an apartment on her own? No. And that's scary. That's scary when you're a person who has to provide for your children and you don't even have a place to live. As part of this program, we have licensed physical therapists on staff because Jane's in trouble, right? And so these individuals are licensed and trained, and they can work with her as part of this program to help her understand fear, to help her cope, to help her understand all of those things that she needs to work through. Okay, and that's a really great part of this program. This is something that's unique that is not available normally in the community unless you have health insurance. I would say that this is something that we are lacking strongly in our community, is the ability to help women cope with everyday stuff. Stress management, you know, parenting, all of those things are something that we're lacking in our general community unless you have health insurance and time away from work to go and participate in those programs. She can also get food stamps. And for food stamps for a household of 3, she would get $497 a month. So actually about the equivalent that she would get for cash assistance that she would use for her household. I don't know if, you know, and to support her family. So that goes along with the program. Now, if someone was to apply for food stamps outside solely on its own, there would be requirements as part of that program as well. So no one unless they need an exemption, like they have a disability or they're old or, you know, something like that. But as long as they're working age, then the expectation is that they work towards employment for either both of these programs. Okay. The next one she could be eligible for is child care assistance. We talked about that as a huge thing. Let's see. So for child, the one thing that Jane will have a hard time with is we can say, yeah, there's child care available, so put your kids in child care and go to work. What can Jane be feeling if she's fleeing her home? And she's always been with her kids. She's been there to take them to school, pick them up after school, and she has fear, okay? Is she going to want to let her kids go? Is she going to be okay with pushing them away to a stranger where she doesn't have control? And it's not about control. It's about safety. It's about her thinking, could my husband get to my kids before I could? I don't know. As mothers, right, our kids are like the world, you know, and letting the world go away in the hands of someone else. When you're in a situation like Jane, it's scary. And so that's something that our licensed clinical therapist helps people like Jane to work through as well, is being able to actually cope with the idea of putting your children away in a safe childcare environment and really looking at quality childcare. That's something our agency does, is what we license childcare providers, and we really look at quality childcare providers and help people know what quality means and when they're looking at childcare providers. One other aspect of childcare that I didn't include here, but I want to talk about is after-school programs. After-school programs are very important, not only for elementary age school children, but on up through teenage. Because if you don't have a program, something for your children to do after school, what do your children do? They get into trouble, or they're lonely, or they don't have direction, they don't have activities, they're not doing things. And when you're living in poverty or low income, you don't have money to put your kids in a lot of different after-school activities. And that's something that's really important. It's really a luxury. And so I think that a fraction of our Title I eligible schools in Utah have after-school programs that are partnered. So we're thinking low-income families are in neighborhoods where they're going to school, but then there aren't any options for especially elementary age parents or school kids to go after school as part of that school program. So childcare is huge. Okay, we work with our community partners, right? We don't offer housing at EWS. We don't offer high school GEDs. We don't offer bachelor's degree at EWS. We have to work with our community partners. So that's what we do, is we call our friends up at the YWCA and say, hey, we need a place for Jane tonight. Jane has two kids. What do we need to help Jane with too, in order to get to the Y tonight, so she has a safe place? And that's one thing that UWS really tries to do, is work with partners in the community, because we can't do it all. And we know that the success, like you were mentioning earlier, it takes a village, right? And so the success of the individuals we work with, the success of our society is based on how we all work together in order to provide all the components that this person is going to need to be successful in the future. Questions about that? Okay, we're going to talk about our third and final contestant here. Avery, she's a 17-year-old girl from a two-parent family. She has two siblings and a cat. I mentioned the cat because the cat is very important to Avery, because it's her friend. It's her person, it's her thing that she talks to when she gets home from school. I'll keep going with this scenario. Her parents work so much that she feels like she hardly ever sees them. Her parents are doing the right thing. They're going to work. They're trying to keep their family in a home, in food, in clothing, in, you know, all of those things. They're doing the right thing. But she's lonely. Her parents aren't there for her. And that's not their fault. I mean, that's just how it is. She starts to hang out with friends after school because she's lonely. She doesn't, you know, no direction. We talked about that. So she stops doing her homework, hanging out with her friends. I don't hang out with my friends to do my homework too, right? So then she starts hanging out with these friends instead of going to school. So here she is. She's 17-year-old. She's been doing the right thing. Her parents have been doing the best that they can so far. she has two younger siblings, and oftentimes older siblings are what left to take care of the younger siblings, okay? And that's a hard thing to do, because when you're 17, you want to hang out and you want to be with your friends. But then what happens to her? What does her future look like at this moment? She quit going to school. Okay? Is her future very bright right out of this moment? But one of the whole programs that we have is it's called it's from the Workforce Investment Act. It's called a youth program. And it's especially designed to help youth get back into school and stay in school. So not only does it help them get their high school diplomas easy, but it promotes the idea of post-secondary education to them. Because it offers incentives. It says, hey, if you go from a D to a C, we're going to give you money. Money is very valuable. I mean, we talked earlier that maybe not as valuable to women, but certainly to teenagers, it's very valuable. If you pass a class, you get some money. If you do this, if you graduate, you get some money. So there are all, and it's not just about going to school and getting your degree. There's a lot of other opportunities too. So there's tutoring and dropout prevention stuff where a person actually mentors the youth and says, hey, this is what your future could look like. This is what you can do. And one of the things I think we're really lacking is mentors for women from first grade on up, showing them some alternative occupations. So, you know, think about in our society, you know, kids go to the doctor. They see the male doctor. They see the female nurse. I mean, our impression of the occupations that are available to us as women start from a very, very early age. We start forming those impressions. When someone comes on career day, the dad comes and talks about being an architect, and they see all their female school teachers around them, right? And so what we need females lighting off the volcano on career day as opposed to the men, you know? And we need to talk to women, especially in rural areas, where these industries, mining, construction, are booming. That is where the bread and butter are, especially if 70-something percent of our female population with children is the head of household. That's where they need to have the jobs that are better paying and not the lower paying jobs. And so we need to start educating our kids about science and technology when they're in first grade and not waiting until they're 17-year-olds, you know, when they're trying to form their career plan. It needs to happen way before because our social impressions have started from the time that we're born, really, you know? That is an aside. Okay. Okay, so not only do we have a WIA youth program, but there's a very similar program for adults. Now, it doesn't pay them money to do things, but it helps subsidize education so that they can increase their skills so that they can be employed, and then also so they're not underemployed. So building those skills as well. And it is a low-income qualification program for this one. But if you're underemployed, you're going to qualify, and it's based on household size. So everyone in your household counts. So you have big Utah families, right? So if you have six kids in your family, bingo, you're in. Let's increase your skills. Let's increase your income. So another thing that I want to talk to you about, especially related to the displaced lingering, it really was a training program fund, and that's what these funds can be used for the same thing, dislocated workers. So this is not an income-eligible program, meaning if you've been laid off, if you're returning from the military, if you were the secondary breadwinner or no income earner in your household, and now, for whatever reason, you have to become the primary breadwinner in your household, you could qualify for these funds to increase your skills, your education training, and your income. So these are available to anyone who has fallen into that. You don't count. You could have earned $200,000 the year before, got laid off from your job, and you would qualify for these funds. Yes.
Are your programs, how are they formed? Is it through statute from the state level or federal or both?
Okay, very good question. Thank you for asking. So Utah is a very unique state in that DWF encompasses health and human services programs as well as Department of Labor programs. So we can have a seamless usage of funds to build people. They don't have to go anywhere else. So someone can come in for a food stamp, and they can come to the same place and, to build their skills and a training program. Okay, we don't offer the training program because we offer the money to go to an accredited training program. I'm not going to teach. Don't worry. Okay, so the Department of Labor and Health and Human Services give the overarching rules that we have to follow, and then our rules fall underneath that. So for the financial assistance program, the STEP program that I talked about, which is the cash assistance for single and two-parent families, we in Utah have a secondary set of rules for those funds. So we say how much the funding is, so how much that monthly cash amount is, and we make a smaller umbrella of rules, and that is state rules. So we can make changes to state rules. We cannot make changes to the federal overarching thing. The federal overarching thing gives us, like, you have to, it has to be a work program. You have to do so many hours per week in these eligible activities. I mean, there's a lot of rules that go along with getting that little bit of cash. So, yes, the federal government says what the work rules are. We say how much money they can make. Department of Labor, we just follow their rules overarching for these training programs, the WIA youth program, the WIA adult program, and then the dislocated youth program often fall under the Department of Labor.
Okay. Well, it would be helpful to me at some point just to have an inventory of the program and to what extent they're federally controlled, and where we have flexibility within the administrative rule, or what programs are state-born, I guess, for lack of...
They're state-born.
None?
Mm-hmm.
Nada?
Nada. They're all federal.
Do any of these preclude us having our own?
No, we just have to have the funds to do it.
Okay.
I lied to you. There's one program I'm not going to address specifically, but it's called General Assistance. You guys might be familiar with that. That is fully funded by state funds. And the very second last slide, I put a little blurb in there about that, just so you'd be aware that an additional program is for people with disabilities.
Okay. So, and the purpose behind that is that if through our information gathering we determine
these people have told us,
something isn't working, to the speaker's earlier point related to child care, then what our potential strategy is to where these shortcomings are, I mean, whether or not it's an administrative role or maybe it's a federal action.
I think we could break it down into information, but I think it might be easier to raise the questions of where it might be, and then we could look and see, is that a state issue or is that a federal overarching issue? That might easier because there's a lot. I mean, I don't know.
Okay, no, that
I'm
mean,
just saying that if the question is posed, if the issue is raised,
okay,
whatever,
yeah,
I
yeah.
could partner to kind
yeah.
of come up
okay.
with.
Okay,
yeah, totally.
Thank you.
Love it. Okay, so we have crisis intervened all three of these customers. Okay, they're all feeling better, they're all in stable environments. Our friend, I can't remember her name, Avery, has finished school. They're all ready to go to work, okay? So I know I'm going longer than I'm supposed to, but I'll go through this really fast. Okay, so these are some of the things that we call work readiness steps. So this is the marketing, okay? They've all got skills. They're all ready to go to work. Now we have to market their skills. So we help them with a resume. This is our job that you have on our website. For job preparation. So we have online workshops. So you don't have to leave the comfort of your own home. You can go online and you can learn how to write a resume through this really awesome interactive workshop that other states have bought because it's so cool. Interviewing, networking, LinkedIn. If you guys all want to update your LinkedIn profile, I can hook you up with a workshop. All of these things are
can be online, or we have them in person. So the online ones are really short. They're like 15 to 20 minutes. For the in-person ones, you know, they're a few hours, and you can ask questions to really smart people about writing your resume and doing all of those things. I don't know if you all are aware, but we got a Department of Labor grant for $4.6 million to improve our website and make it more user-friendly. Because they like our ideas so much in the department. So, we are currently starting year two of a four-year grant project, and it's a study to see if adding some components and making them available online will help job seekers. Okay, so you can, one of the other cool things we do is anyone can walk in, any one of you can walk into our office with your resume and have a critique. That's a really important part because I think a lot of people, there's a lot of misnomers about resumes, that sort of thing, and I think having someone who is professionally trained to do it to go over and say, hey, yeah, that's an awesome resume, or oh no, you cannot have your email address at Hotmail or on there because that's not going to get you the right kind of job. So we can do that. We can do mock interviews in the offices, all of that stuff to help people know how to market their skills. So this is a list of all of the things that we use. So these are all of our workshops. And then have you all ever heard of utahteachers.org? I think she'll start being in 7th grade. But it's mandatory 7th through 12th grade for students, and they go on as an online career counseling tool. And it's actually the new iteration of it, Utah Built, is coming out August 16th. So you can just go to utahteachers.org. It is awesome. And you can build a career roadmap. You can talk about, and it'll show you exactly what classes you take in 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, and 12th grade. If you want to be an accountant, it'll show you exactly the classes that you need to take that will go to that. Now, this iteration doesn't have it, but in the future, it'll also show CTE courses that would build upon that, which you should take if you want to go into the occupation, and then higher education courses as well. Right now, it has links to all of the schools that offer those programs. You can go in and look for yourself. In the future, it'll have every single one of the senior classes outlined. So there will be no missteps for you as you're choosing your awesome paying female power occupation. Okay, we have another program, Work Success. Work Success is really cool. It's a 40-hour-a-week program. Anyone can do it. If you're on unemployment, you can do it. If you're not on unemployment, you can do it. If you're receiving cash assistance, you can do it. And if you're just one of us walking in off the street, you can totally do it. But it helps you. It really gives you 40 hours a week focus on how to job search. So it gives you all those components that I talked about in a nice little club package. You go there, you network with the people around you. If so-and-so hears about a job, they can bring you back and tell the group, and everybody goes applies for that job. And so it's a really cool thing, and it's gotten like 77% outcomes. So 77% of people who participate in this thing get jobs, no matter who you are, male, female, old, young. Awesome and awesomer. Okay, I just wanted to share with you this story. I'm not going to read it out loud because it would take 2.3 seconds. And I will let you read it. It's in your packet. But this is just one of the things that this is from one of our customers. She was a financial assistance customer, so she was receiving financial assistance through child care. And it tells a little bit of her story. She got a job. And I think that there's a lot of people in our state who think that people don't want to get jobs. You know, people who are on financial assistance or people who are on visa don't want to get jobs. And that's not the case. Because every one of these stories are people who don't know how, but because of the tools that we've been able to provide for them through our services and then also with our partnering agencies, they are successful and they can get jobs because they want to get jobs. They just don't know how. They don't know where to. These are other courses. This is something I want to mention too. These are things that we partner with Utah State University. They use these workshops, and they're really life skills workshops. So this one's called Finding Healthy Relationships. Its old title was How to Not Date a Jerk or a Jerkette, which I actually liked a little bit better. But you know, this is a little more PC. Strengthening the couple relationship and parenting with love and logic. This is something that we are missing in general society. A lot of our offices do budgeting workshops too, science based. And I think that that is really something that is missing from these women's lives. So you have
you have no money or you have a little bit of money and then you get assistance and you can get a job or a better job through us. But then how do you manage that money? I mean, financial management is a big thing that we're missing in our society for women, because it's hard. And when you're not making very much money and housing is this much money, you need to know how to manage that. And so that's definitely something that we're missing just in general across the board. Okay, so these are the programs that we also do that I'm not going to talk about because it would take longer than I'm actually talking. Okay, Veteran Services, Refugee Services, General Assistance is the program I was talking about a second ago. Bonding is a program that, so if someone has a background history or they have bad credit or something like that and they want to get into a financial job or something that pays a little bit more, we can bond them. Which means we just give them, we work with an insurance company, so if they happen to steal something, then they pay the employer. So it's no cost to the employer, no stress, no fuss, no much. Work opportunity tax credit gives employers money, tax incentives for hiring veterans and individuals who have experienced homelessness. And then rapid response is something that we do. So when an employer calls us and they say, hey, we're going to lay off 50 people, we go out and we talk to those 50 people and tell them how to apply for unemployment insurance and what we can do for them to help get back into the workplace immediately. Oftentimes we have other employers who want to hire those individuals at that place. So hopefully we can just get them a job right away, in the dream world. So that's what we do to make certain people's dreams happen. Do you guys have questions? Thank you. Thank you again for your time. I appreciate it.
So one thing I'm interested in is how these services are marketed. So that's one. I don't need to know the answer right now, but that's something that I'm curious about. And then accessibility in different areas. I can get to, and actually when I first moved to this state, Department of Workforce Services did help me get a job, seriously. And I didn't know where to look, and I didn't have a network because I was just out of college and didn't really know anybody here. But I also live downtown within reasonable walking distance of Workforce Services. And I appreciate the access online, but not everybody has connectivity either. So those are the kinds of top of mind questions that I have about related to this. Anyone else have any other questions?
My only comment is that what jumped out to me, of course, because of where I work is, and I'm very ecstatic that Rebecca's story, that she's got a job and great. But my thought was, she's very obviously a self-starter, and she's working in the customer service position. Perhaps at the plumbing company, they could offer her, or she could think that she was worthy to become an apprentice in that company, and eventually a journeyman apprentice, which would quadruple her salary. And of course, we not even entering the union forces at all, just hypothetically a plumbing company. So that's what jumps out to me, because she's probably making minimum wage, which is good for her because she just started. But 2 years, she should be, that's all. But did she know out of high school that these programs were available for her? If she wasn't going to go to college, or if she, what other options are available for her to go into them? Anyway, good for her. Good story. Good Rebecca's story.
I think that goes to, at DWS, we've been working on also understanding underemployment. It seems to be rampant across the economy currently, and I think that what we're learning out of that could also feed into what we want to do here at the Commission, because that, while that you said it's sort of our starting point, if everybody's, it seems as though we're at a place in the economy, when you go through that recovery period, that's where everybody ends up, or a lot of people end up in that lower tier. And how do we make sure that as the economy grows, that people get those opportunities? And given what we're learning here, I think women especially have to be
helped, or not helped more, but more, made even more aware of that need to push, to look for those opportunities and not get stuck in that underemployment situation.
So, I'd like to know from the perspective of DWS, are any of these programs duplicative, or in any way they don't work well together, or if maybe the federal requirements were different, would you design it differently to serve better?
Yes.
Or, so, yeah, so those are the things I'd like to hear about. Is what isn't working, what's working really good, what isn't quite working, and if you were creating, what would you do to make them work better?
I think that when we put Amber and I can sit down together and sort of inventory, like you guys were talking about, inventory the programs to talk about the Fed rules, the state rules, what, if any, marketing is happening on this, and then also where are duplications or gaps.
Or gaps or whatever.
Yeah. I think we could put that
if
analysis.
If you've had a lot of experience with a lot of clients over and over, and you're just like, I can't serve these people. I wish I could, but there's no place for them. Or if only this requirement was a little bit different, it could really help these people.
That kind of feeds into, I think, the cycle of poverty, people being stuck. And I think later on we'll hear from Tracy Gruber, and maybe we'll get even more information on where we can help with that.
I a lot of what was discussed in the presentation related to outreach and tools, and I know that private industry does that as well, too, as the job fairs and things of that nature. So if you all could think about things that you all have done that have worked, including raising the possibility in mind about what's available, what kinds of careers are available, that maybe we could replicate in some other way or partner with, or what over the weekend, I went to an elementary school. Fidelity Investments focuses on a school, or has the last few years, in the area I'm honored to represent. And one of their financial planners had talked about, and a customer base that they're getting more and more are widowed women who have not had, maybe traditionally have not had a lot of control over the finances, and then all of a sudden are left with a lot, and then maybe don't know what to do with them. So that's another aspect. I don't know what this sounds like. You guys do a lot of education, and that's what made me think about it too. I think so. Does anyone else have any other? Are you scouting or thinking?
No, thinking. I mean, ages and stages, isn't it?
Oh, I like that as well, too.
So not, I mean, it was touched on a little bit in the presentation as well, the teenager as well as the 20, 30-something mother, but we have women throughout their working life cycles that we need to pay attention to, some of them who have never been in the workforce and are finding themselves and others who have stopped and started, and others who have done work continuously, and maybe unrelated. So I'm looking at how we can look at women in the economy throughout that cycle.
So I want to move on to Tracy Gruber, and as she sets up, I'll introduce her. You all at the table may or may not be aware of the legislation that was passed three sessions ago. No, I was. Do you have your thumb? If not, I have my thumb drive.
You have it on your thumb drive?
Yes. Legislation that was passed called the Intergenerational Poverty Mitigation Act. It started with a call for DWS to track intergenerational poverty through our administrative data. They quickly realized that tracking was one thing and doing something about it was another, so subsequent legislation created a commission and a committee to address issues of intergenerational poverty, to use the data that was that is generated by DWF to form policy. And okay. And so here we've hired Tracy Gruber as our senior advisor to the intergenerational poverty research in our division, and she's going to kind of connect these two. I think there's a lot of overlap between the goals of these two groups, and so I asked her to come and talk about intergenerational poverty in women.
Thanks, Carrie. While she's working on that, you can see my PowerPoint slides. They're in your folder. I know we're short on time, and I'm not going to take up a lot of your time, but I thought that this was a great opportunity to kind of link women in the economy and the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative, which focuses about a subset of women in the economy. These are the women in intergenerational poverty, and as my slides say, they're working and raising families. So, as Carrie said, the intergenerational poverty work is an initiative in Utah that no other state has embarked on, trying to look at what is going on in people's lives who are a subset maybe of the people Amber talked about. She was primarily talking about people in situational poverty, job loss, divorce, possibly a death in the family. Intergenerational poverty is really talking about multiple generations of people in poverty. And that's the starting point of this, and trying to understand what is it about those families and those individuals that are keeping them in poverty, and are the programs that the state offers across agencies and within the Department of Workforce Services really addressing these needs, or are programs designed more to deal with situational poverty? So the legislation is very much starting with the children of intergenerational poverty, and this is directly from the legislation that we're trying to measurably reduce the incidence of children in the state who remain in the cycle of poverty and welfare dependency as they become adults. And we're doing this through data and research to come up with evidence-based policies and programs across state government in multiple areas that are touching children's lives. So we've got the Department of Workforce Services, Department of Health, Department of Human Services, Utah State Office of Education, and the Juvenile Court, all involved in this initiative. And just to give you a framework for who we're talking about in intergenerational poverty, we have all these people on public assistance, adults on public assistance. About 25% of them, I think it's more like 24, between 24 and 25%, also received public assistance as children. And without getting into too much about it's not capturing everybody, which we know it isn't, we have about 25% of our public assistance roles that were receiving public assistance when they too were kids. What this means is that we have 52,000 children living in intergenerational poverty, but we also have about 236,000 children that are at risk of becoming in intergenerational, remaining in poverty when they become adults. And that's based on research that shows that even out of BYU, that even 1 month of public assistance as a child can predict that you are likely to remain there as an adult. So that's who we're talking about. And who are these adults? We know that 65% of them are women, which is why part of the reason that we thought having this information for you is you start your work on this commission to think about these women in intergenerational poverty. We know that they're young women. 84% of them are 34 years or younger, or 34 years old or younger. 75% of them are single. This kind of reflects some of the data that we heard earlier. We've got a lot of single women in our state. The intergenerational poverty cohort, majority single women. And we know that 86% of them have children. And these are the 52,000 children living in intergenerational poverty. It's about 6% of our child population, but when you go back and you look at that 236,000 and you add that to the 52, it's about 30% of our child population.
What I didn't say about these kids, which is very important, is that the majority of them are 12 years old and younger. And we know that early intervention services for children are really, you've got a lot of bang for your buck when you can address early childhood development issues. Some additional information about the IGP female cohort. Again, it reflects a lot of the other poverty data that a lot of us are familiar with. They're really limited education. Without answering reasons why, although a lot of us can probably guess, access to opportunity, cultural differences in education within low-income families. Mom or dad didn't have an education. They're living in communities where education is not as high quality. So we know that the majority of them do not have an education beyond high school. And when you look at the Utah numbers, it's really staggering the difference between the IGP. I also did a quick look at what sectors these women are in administrative support, waste management, retail trade, food service, healthcare and social assistance, which is like CNA type work. And then when you look at the sectors for men, a lot of them are very much the same, although we see the area of construction and manufacturing come into play, which in some cases is a higher paying, low skilled occupation. And what do we know about these sectors for the women and for the men for the most part that we see our IGP cohorts in? Low wages, they have non-traditional work hours, which makes child care issues very difficult. So even if you're going to give a child care subsidy through one of DWS's programs, so many child care facilities don't offer non-traditional hours. So if you're part-time and you have to work a late shift, what are you going to do with this? Well, you can't take the job. I mean, you can't leave the child at home, but you can't find high-quality child care. And we talked about concerns about leaving your children in situations that you might not be completely comfortable in. This is an issue, given the importance of child care for consideration, addressing non-traditional hours. They have little or no benefits. A lot of them are part-time, and a lot of them are high turnover. And then we see kind of the wage distribution of the jobs that were on average. These are average annual wages, so you can look at this and say, oh, $30,000, that's not poverty wage. But you're looking at the average across the entire sector. But what I did look at was the IGP women, their annual wages compared to the IGP men. They're $2,000 less than a wage that's already at only $12,000. So we're not talking about a lot of money already, and then you kind of bump that down and see that they're earning less when you look across how many quarters they've spent working and what their wages have been for the year. And when you look at the Utah number for the annual non-farm wage, it's significantly less. So no surprise that these families find themselves needing a lot of public assistance services. We're looking in the data and the report, what else is going on in these families. We're seeing educational outcomes that are troubling. We're seeing a lot of many instances of abuse and neglect rates that are higher than the statewide rate. For people who are involved in poverty issues, we know that poverty is not just a function of not having enough money. There's a lot of other things going on. So just for context of why we're doing the intergenerational poverty work at the state, we have 52,000 children, 236,000 children. They're going to be entering our economy. If Utah wants to remain at the top of their economy, we need to make sure the parents that are raising these kids have the ability to meet their needs and make sure that the kids themselves are getting access to opportunity so that when they're adults, they're going to be contributing members of the economy. And what we're doing actually aligns a lot with looking at cliff effects and looking at overlapping programs. So that is going on within the context of intergenerational poverty, and it sounds like that's going to be one of the objectives of this group, is to look at some of that duplication. And the five agencies that are working on intergenerational poverty are starting to have that policy-based discussion. from case, how to make sure that case management services are not being duplicated. So if you have an issue in a family, you don't have five different case managers from five different agencies. Those conversations are starting to happen. Looking at federal programs and federal requirements and what type of obstacles and barriers are they putting on us as a state in order to develop programs that are going to meet the needs of these families so that they can become self-reliant. We are obviously using data and research to come up with these programs, and at least one program that I can mention here for DWF is a new pilot program for that's going to start in September to look at providing case management for intergenerational poverty families specifically, that will provide services that looks at the entire family and the needs of the kids, because we all know that it's very difficult for mom to go to work every day if she has no child care or spreading about her child who might be ill or any of those other issues. So the Next Generation Kids Pilot is an initial attempt to understand their needs and better address them. And that's just a little bit of background. Stay tuned, because the next report is going to come out in September, and it's going to have a lot of information that I think will be relevant to this group. Does anybody have any questions? Thanks again for the opportunity.
So thank you all. And we will, I'm not sure the best way it is to schedule meetings. I'm respectful of other people's times, but also your two co-chairs right now are in a limited lifespan as far as elected officialdom are concerned. And since we're results-oriented, I can imagine we'll be doing a lot of work over the next couple months. The other thing that we are able to do in statute is create subcommittees too. So please be thinking about that as the data comes forward and as your areas of interest, think about how we can categorize that. What's the best way to set meetings? And do you all do SurveyMonkey or I don't know?
Have you ever used a Doodle poll before?
Great. Mm-hmm. Anything else top of mind?
I would like to make a suggestion as to where we meet. You know, legislative committees have access to the, well, we should all have access to the committee rooms, you know, upstairs. But we, in the legislature, we live stream our meetings so people at home can listen or at work can listen. And I am the chair of the Transparency Advisory Board, which is staffed by the Division of Finance. And, you know, we just figured out this last month how to have the executive branch live stream our meetings. So I think it would be really nice to have our meetings in a room where we have, you know, public access. People can come and sit in and listen and participate and give public comment, and also, you know, have the capacity to live stream. That's my suggestion.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, and it speaks to getting out to all people and hearing their experience and questions too. So thank you for that. Anything else? Okay, thanks. And thanks to you all from DWS for helping to put this together, and your continued efforts, and for lunch, and for water, and for the space, and for the projector, and everything. We're very appreciative.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Sure,
do you want
to just bring
it?
Yeah, I'll
do all
the bike. Yeah.
So one of the main points was